Good morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, many of you know that today marks the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, which ended U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War and swept communist North Vietnamese forces into power in South Vietnam. For many people living in or near Saigon at that time, that meant that they were faced with a fearful choice to remain in Vietnam and face possible imprisonment or worse at the hands of the communists, or to get out of Vietnam and flee for the United States any way they could. Our first two guests this morning made that courageous second choice. It meant great danger, hardship, it meant the uncertainty of starting over in a new and unfamiliar land. But Rosa and Minh Van Phan not only survived their separate ordeals, they thrived here in Southern California and met one another here and married. We'll be visiting with both of them individually in the first two segments of our show today, and we'll begin with Minh Van Phan, who knew only too well what the communists were capable of, and he knew it years before the fall of Saigon. Minh, first of all, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming down to be with us in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
When you were a kid, your family lived in Central Vietnam, and you were conspicuous, you and your family, because you were Catholic. Tell us what happened as a result of that.
Well, we have two places in Vietnam, one in Nha Trang, and then the other one in a small village about 100 miles from Nha Trang, down south of Nha Trang. We're the only family in that village. We are only Catholic family in that village. And that village is about over 3,000 families in that village.
And when the communists would come down from the mountains at night, as you mentioned before, what happened then?
On January 5th, 1963, you know, that particular village was during the day, usually the South Vietnam government would control, but at night, usually, the Vietnamese communists would usually come down and, disturb our village. And that is the night that was one of the shocking nights in my life. That particular village didn't have any much electricity at that time. We one night, January 5th, 1963, I remember vividly, my house was surrounded by the Vietnamese communists, surrounded my house and took my father out in front of us and execute him in front of us. With my mom, at that time, just have my youngest brother deliver, my youngest brother only 1 week old. And they execute my dad, and because he's the Catholic, because he doesn't like communists, and he's very, very helpful man, and he's one of the considered a nicest man in that village, help a lot of people. And because I think because one of the issue, because he's a Catholic, we're the only Catholic family in that area.
Well, you and your family subsequently moved south. Away from the communist forces.
Yes, the next day after they killed my father, the night before, and the next day they threatened that they're going to kill the whole family. So my mom and my two younger brothers and my younger sister left that place, and then went to Nha Trang, back to my original home, Nha Trang. And we stayed there until the end of 1975.
And you spent some time in the Christian Brothers Seminary. You were studying to be a brother, a Christian brother.
Yes, I was in the seminary 1967 through to 1975. It's a La San, the Christian brother. I was very fortunate, raised and educated by those Christian brothers.
Well, let's talk about now the days leading up to the fall of Saigon on April 30th, 1975. On April 25th, I remember you saying that you decided it was time that you had to get out, you and your family. Tell us how that happened.
Well, about the March of 1975, the communists threatened took over Nha Trang. So we are fortunate that my sister would work for the U.S. Consulate here. So the American took us out.
The American military forces,
you know, took us out the last day of Nha Trang. And we stay in Saigon until the April 25th, which is the same way. We are very fortunate. American military took us out April 25th, 1975, to Guam.
Okay, yeah. You were airlifted directly.
We airlifted directly to Guam.
And every one of the Vietnamese refugees really were processed through Guam at one point.
At
right?
that time, you know, whoever airlifted usually arrived in Guam.
Okay.
First. Yeah.
And
yeah.
You were briefly in Guam, and then you came to Southern California to Camp Pendleton.
We stayed in Guam about 10 days. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they transferred to Camp Pendleton for 4 months. We stayed in Camp Pendleton for 4 months.
Tell us about the conditions in Camp Pendleton. You were living in a tent.
Yeah, I experienced the weather. That's the first night was so cold. We live under the tent. And it's still waters underground. They just put very quick and put the tent together and, you know, put us there. But the weather is so cold at night, it's so freezing cold. And it just, I mean, I was, the whole family, everybody was shaking like, you know, we're in Alaska somewhere that in a freezing cold. That's what's my experience of the weather.
My goodness. Yeah. And you were there for how long?
We stayed there for 4 months. And after that, we have one of the church, Catholic church in Covina, sponsored in, and we arrived in California on October.
And you moved to Covina, right?
We moved to Covina, October, yes.
And the early days in Covina were not easy for you, as I understand. You had to kind of climb the job ladder from the bottom.
Yes. I remember on October when we left Camp Pendleton, the U.S. government gave us $300 per head. That's how we started. Very grateful for that moment. And when we were in Covina, my first job was a janitor. So I cleaned toilet. Rubbing toilet, clean, vacuum the whole tri-community school. My single-handed do the whole thing. It's over 20 restroom. Was the worst job in life, which is at that time. I experienced, you know, I cry every time I rub the toilet. I cry, and I say I will never do this again if I don't have to. And yes, after 6 months, I left. I have found a different job.
And what job did you get subsequently? This kind of started you on the road up.
On the road up, I worked for the as an assembler for the one of the company make a sprinkler system. They call Randbird, which is think they're still around this moment. And I was the assembler and move up to a machinist. And then during the day, I worked during the day, and at night I went to school at night and move up from there on.
Just to back up a bit, you were actually one of the luckier ones in Vietnam at the time because you were airlifted out by the military. There were so many who were trapped there.
That's
and
right.
It was the influence of your sister, I believe, who worked for the consulate.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Now, once you were established in Covina and you're in a better job now, eventually you founded your own company. Tell us just a bit about that in the couple of minutes we have left.
Yes, after I graduated 1979-80, and I worked as an electronic engineer, worked for a few startup firm mm-hmm. as an engineer. And 1979, I met my lovely wife. And 1984, after 5 years chasing her, 1984, we got married. By 1989, we started our own company because I think this land is a land of opportunity, and I see a lot of opportunity for us to move, to grow, and to do something different for this, you know, for our life. So my wife and I start a company in 1989, and we after a couple of years, we won a very big contract with the government, upgrading all the old computer into a faster computer with the very minimum cost. That's how we start our business. And we changed from a computer business to remote video surveillance business. And year 2005, we sold that company. And in 2006, we started another company. You know, my wife and I started another company. And we do the pump top TV, which is we put all these large screen on top of the gas pump throughout the United States, about 25 states. In 2012, we sold that company. And now we start another company, which is only the last couple of years, called Bella V Network, which is now, this is the time that I feel like a lot of stuff for, before I have done a lot of business, and it's just for us, for ourselves. But the Bella V Network is something for everybody that I feel like a time to give back to community.
We will pick that up in just a minute when we come back, but we're going to take a couple of minutes, and we will be back talking with Min's wife, Rose, about her experience. Please stay with us.
Thank you.
The Orange County Catholic Newspaper is now available for weekly home delivery. The official newspaper of the Diocese of Orange seeks to illuminate and animate the journey of faith for Catholics within the Diocese of Orange. Through timely sharing of news, commentary, and feature content in an engaging, accessible, and compelling format, please call 1-877-627-7009 or visit OCCatholic.com to subscribe.
We're back, and we're speaking with Rosa and Min Van Phan about their respective escapes from Vietnam on this, the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And Rosa is here right with us in the studio. Let's pick up your story. Four decades ago, you're 17 years old. You're studying at a French Catholic school in Saigon, and in come the North Vietnamese forces. And your family didn't leave immediately. What happened to you and your family, and particularly your father? Tell us about that.
Well, when the communists took over, my father wasn't at home. Even we got a telegram from my aunt to get out of Vietnam, but we didn't know how. Mm-hmm. So after that, we just couldn't go to school because everything stopped. My future seemed to be ended. Whatever I was hoping for seemed to be stopped. We didn't know exactly what the communism was about, but after that, somehow there was a teacher, a violin teacher of my brother, came to the house to educate my mom, say that he escaped the North in 1954. He really understands what communism is all about. And he advised my mom to make sure to get us out of this new regime. He really cares for our family, so he gave my mom that advice. Well, from there on, I knew that my father was trying in many ways to find a way, but we really didn't know what was gonna happen. And months after that, my father attempted the first organization to get us out by boat. But unfortunately, he was tricked by the people that worked with him and so stole all the jewelry, the gold, whatever that he was told to give to them to be put in the boat the day before we're supposed to leave. And after that, they sold him out. So he was taken away without us knowing where he was taken to. Later on, my mom found out that, you know, he was put in prison and tortured. And after a lot of efforts to pay some people, he finally was released with the condition that he had to confess the lesser amount of gold that they took in order for him to be released.
And he eventually was released.
Yeah, he was released, but then he was put into a public trial by the poor people of the town who were not even an official courtroom. that was quite humiliating. But that's what happened.
But it didn't stop him from trying to get your family out of Vietnam. He planned another escape by boat, and this one worked.
Yes, the second attempt. It was a miracle, actually. In about June 1976, after a year staying with the communists, my father finally managed to arrange the escape this time. And it was not even funded by our own money, but by some very, very wealthy people who really wanted to go. So we happened to be altogether 94 people. It was unthinkable, and it was impossible for anything like that to happen. But we started from a hideout on the river, very small river by Binh Hoa. And then we went from there out to sea, supposedly, from Box, moved to larger boats, about less than 30 feet wide, I mean long, and probably about, well, I can't remember, but it was a small boat. It happened to be two boats. And at the last rendezvous, we're supposed to meet with the larger boats to take us on a long journey. But those two boats didn't show up. At that moment, I guess my father had to make a decision, hard decision. All the 94 people's lives are in his hands, were in his hands. So he finally decided we just went on, regardless whether we were equipped or not. We just move on.
And eventually, your father organized a takeover of the boat that you were on, right?
Well, before that, a few days after that, because the boats we were on were not equipped with enough provisions, and so we ran out of water. But then we got the storm, and we had water. And after that, we ran out of gasoline. So the two boats just kind of stopped and drifted. And amazingly, a big ship showed up with a gun shot in the air, and all of us had to raise our arms up. The first thing we did, we pray. And then my father volunteered to get on their ship to do something. Afterwards, I found out he went up there to negotiate. There was a communist patrol ship. They had guns and cannons on the ship. And after that, I guess the negotiation didn't work out or something. We were all forced to get on their ship. And so they towed our two boats behind. And on the way, they took us back. I knew first thing when I got on that ship, I was so determined that I could not accept to go back. Because I just imagined my father would be killed for sure, and the family would no longer be together. And everybody probably should be sent to a labor concentration camp. So I was so determined that, however, somehow, we had to make it different. And then my father was very, very brave. I could see, I could feel that he felt the same way. So he planned the attack, the sudden attack, with a few brave men, and we took over the ship.
Let me condense time a little bit here. You took over the ship. The ship is in your hands now. You are eventually met by a ship from Thailand, correct?
We met some small fishing boat, Thai fishing boat, that led us to Thailand. And it was right there between the border of Thailand and Malaysia, right at the end of the country of Thailand. And when we arrived, it was ironical that it was hard to explain that we were not communists. Even the flag of the communists was painted on the ship, in the middle of the wall, on the wall in the middle of the ship. And we had to plead that we were refugees. We were running away. We were not communists. So finally, my father got to speak their language and convinced them that to inform some Americans, embassy or something, later on, there were three American CBS journalists came down.
Well, again, forgive me for compressing time a little bit here, but you went from Thailand through Guam, am I right?
No.
Or just straight to California?
Straight from Thailand, and we stayed, and then the journalists took us, they got on our ship and took us to a refugee camp in Songkla, and then we stayed there for a couple months, and then we were sponsored by our aunts who lived here before and came straight from Thailand to California in 1976 on August 2nd.
Okay. And when you arrived here, you went through, just like your husband, a series of fairly menial jobs, but you went back to school, you began studying piano again, and eventually you ended up at UCLA, and you were rooming with... Take it from there.
Yeah, I was rooming with a Korean girl at first, but then after that, the orientation, there was a Vietnamese girl wanted to switch, and she became my roommate. It turned out that she was my husband's sister. And before that, I taught the piano at this house of this American man who worked in a consulate and married a Vietnamese woman. I taught their two kids piano, and that's where I met my husband.
Well, let me bring you both in again here at the same time, if you don't mind. Both of these stories are amazing. There are so many things that you could chalk up to coincidence or luck or you name it, but both of you feel very strongly that there was a much larger hand in this. Tell us about that.
Definitely believe every second of my life that happened, bad or good, dangerous or not, was always protected by God. And God has watched over myself, my family, and everything that had happened. One big word that I always remember is to say to be grateful to God and to all the people in America that had received me.
Well, one last thing here. Min, I know you you agree with your wife to the extent now that you have been accepted into the diaconate program for the Diocese of Orange. You must feel very happy about that.
Yes, I feel very happy and very grateful. And I'm semi-retired right now, so I promised God that I'll dedicate the rest of my life to serve the church, to serve other people. That's my goal.
Well, Rose and Min Van Phan, it has been a real pleasure speaking with you today and hearing about your journey from a very dangerous place in time to another home and life where you have been so happy and successful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
God bless.
We'll be back shortly to hear about yet another anniversary, this one involving one of the Diocese of Orange's most successful schools. Stay with us. This is Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000.
County Catholic Radio is made possible by the generous support to the Orange Catholic Foundation, an independent, not-for-profit organization raising funds to support the mission of the Catholic Church in the Diocese of Orange. To learn more about their vision, their mission, and about upcoming events, visit online www.orangecatholicfoundation.org. That's orangecatholicfoundation.org.
Hello once again. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, for those of you keeping score at home, Rosary High School in Fullerton has been around for a half century now. And this year is the all-girls school's 50th anniversary. We've got Judy Luttrell, Rosary's principal, on the line with us this morning. But before we get into our conversation, I want to provide just a little bit of background about the school, which I'm sure Judy's familiar with. Orange County was still part of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles when Rosary was founded in September of 1965. They were administered then by the Sisters of St. Joseph of Orange. Originally, the school was intended for girls who lived in the central and northeastern parts of Orange County, but today the students can come from as far away as Los Angeles, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties. Judy, first of all, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, when students and parents go looking for an all-girls school in Southern California today, Rosary's one of the top choices that pop out of the pack. Why do you think it enjoys the reputation it does?
Well, you know, there's so many reasons, and as you mentioned, we started in 1965, and although our diocese has changed, one of our hallmarks is our dedication to our traditions. So, for example, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Orange, who founded the school, are still a very vibrant member of our community, so we're very happy to have that association. And then, of course, all of the advantages associated with all girls' education.
Well, that's what I want to get into in just a second here. You probably have to make this pitch a lot, but what do you say to a student or a parent who's skeptical about the idea of attending an all-girls school? What advantages do you point out to them?
Well, I could talk anecdotally about my own experience as a graduate of an all-girls Catholic high school, but I don't know how persuasive that would be. But I would direct them to the research of Dr. Linda Sachs at UCLA, who in 2009 did a very comprehensive study about some of the advantages of all-girls schools. So, for example, female graduates have a higher degree of academic engagement than their co-ed peers. They outperform their co-ed peers on the SAT composite scores by an average of 28 points. Dr. Sachs's study showed that female graduates of single-gender schools enter college with more confidence in math, computer science, writing, and public speaking. Graduates of all-girls high schools have a greater interest in graduate degrees once they attend college, and they even have a greater degree of political engagement once they graduate. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, what about your, you mentioned your own experience in an all-girls school. How did that affect your own life and your career?
Well, you know, being in an all-girls environment, you might think that not having boys around would be a disadvantage, but really, high school girls have never had a problem finding boys to hang around with. What was great for me was the feeling of freedom that I could have every leadership position was available to me in a school. I didn't have to compete with the boys for that. I didn't really have to worry about my appearance while I was in the classroom. You know, a lot of data show that teachers call on boys more than they call on girls, so
yes,
that alone was an advantage, that I was free to be intellectually curious and not have to worry about turning off possible male attention.
Well, it isn't as if there are no boys in the lives of Rosary girls, because you can tell me about this as well, I hope. Servite in particular has several programs that work in concert with Rosary, right?
Oh, sure. All of our dances, even our rallies, are co-school events. So we host the dances sometimes at our schools. Servite hosts them sometimes when we have our homecoming rallies, things like that. We're over there or they're over here. I can't tell you how many times when Servite has an early dismissal and we don't, that I'm literally beating the boys off with a stick to who are here to deliver the lunches to the girls.
Well, you mentioned, I think, that a high percentage of Rosary graduates go on to college, much higher than many public high schools or even Catholic high schools around. What sort of feedback do you get from your alumni who do go to college? Is it easier for them to get into college when the admissions people look at their application and see that they attended Rosary?
Well, it's not just because they attended Rosary, but like I said, it's because they've had the opportunity to experience every leadership opportunity and all of the related skills that you develop in being in a leadership role at a girls' school. So every student body president is a girl, and every club moderator president is a girl. All of our team captains are girls. So in that way, yes, I do think that it makes that our graduates a little more appealing to the colleges to which they're applying. You know, we have really great national merit scholars. We get accepted You know, we've been tracking this now for about 25 years. We didn't track it for the entire 50-year history of Rosary, but for the last 25 years, 100% of our students go on to either a 2-year or 4-year college experience.
That is a fantastic record. Tell me a little bit about the spiritual life at Rosary. Is it any different, or is it tailored in any way to an all-female population, any different than it might be at, say, Mater Dei or at Santa Margarita, where the student body is co-ed?
Well, in general, I'd say no. We're obviously all on the same page in terms of supporting our faith formation of our students. But at Rosary High School, it's especially important to honor our patroness, our Blessed Mother. So we believe her to be the highest, best iteration of womanhood. So obviously, service to others and expecting God's plan for us is very specific to us as women. So one of the things we try to do is emulate the Sisters of St. Joseph motto of service to the dear neighbor. So, for example, this Friday, over 100 of our students will volunteer at the Faley Games, sort of Special Olympics type event, and will serve as volunteers providing support and encouragement to the special athletes in conjunction with Cal State Fullerton. So service to others and emulating the Blessed Mother is a big piece of our faith formation.
Wonderful. I want to get back to the question of alumni again. In a lot of schools around the country that are male-only schools, you always hear about the idea of the old boy network or the strong alumni ties and the leg up, so to speak, that alumni can give to the younger students or the graduating students. Is there something like that that exists at Rosary? Are the alumni ties quite strong and remain strong?
Yeah, and I can give you a great example of that. As part of our 50th Jubilee celebration this year, on March 31st, we had Career Day. And the way we structured it this year were alumni from every decade of Rosary High School came back to share with their students their experiences and their sisterhood at Rosary High School. So they stay in close ties with the school and with our current students. And the other night, we had our award ceremony, and we had an alumna come back, Elizabeth Wydra, who's a Supreme Court litigator and sort of legal analyst on various television stations, and she works at the Constitutional Law Center, and she was motivated enough to come all the way back from Washington to recognize our student scholars.
Fantastic. Well, Rosary's also known for its athletic programs. In Orange County Catholic recently, as you probably know, we've been pretty regularly featuring profiles and columns and features on Rosary athletes. Is this something that is relatively recent, say, within the last 15, 20 years, or has Rosary always been known for this?
You know, Rosary's always been, I think, a big player in Orange County sports. I think what's unique about Rosary is that we're small enough for girls to experience various sports and be competitive in various sports throughout their time at Rosary High School. And we're also kind of talented at getting girls to discover what their athletic abilities are. For example, Natalie Golda, who was a water polo Olympian,
right,
had never played water polo before she came to Rosary High School.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And please go on. I mean, I imagine there are several other athletes that have gone on to really stellar careers in college and elsewhere.
Well, we've had some students go on to play in adult softball, and we have, you know, a high number of students. We had 11 students last year sign for full athletic scholarships to colleges. And it's not always an easy decision for them because they get multiple offers.
Well, in the minute or so we have left, I'd like to wind up by asking you about your role. How long have you been principal at Rosary now, and how rewarding do you find it?
Well, this is my second year at Rosary High School.
Oh, you're a rookie.
I am. I've been in the Diocese of Orange for quite a while, and I've had the pleasure of working at several high schools in the diocese, but this is the crowning privilege of my ministry in Catholic schools because, as I mentioned earlier, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, and it did so much for me to be able to give that back now in the latter part of my career is really, really a privilege and a blessing.
Well, Judy Luttrell, thank you so much for being with us today and for helping us celebrate a half century, amazing, a half century of great education at Rosary High School.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for talking to me about it. Go Royal.
And great good luck with the next half century. When we return, we'll hear about one of the most successful workshops in Orange County. Don't go away.
May 18th through May 23rd is Wills and Trusts Week in the Diocese of Orange and is proudly sponsored by the Orange Catholic Foundation and the Catholic Cemeteries. Take advantage of one of the free sessions and learn how to protect those you love with a new or updated estate plan. Through proper planning, the legacy of love and care you leave for your family and friends can be encouraging and inspiring. If you have questions on how to begin or update your estate plan, please join us at one of the many sessions planned at convenient parish locations throughout our diocese during the week of May 18th. For a complete list of locations and schedule, visit our website, orangecatholicfoundation.org. That's orangecatholicfoundation.org. Or call 714-282-3021. That's 714-282-3021. Admission is free and reservations are not necessary, but welcome. Details are available at orangecatholicfoundation.org. We look forward to seeing you soon.
We're back, and pull up a chair because we're about to learn about one of the great success stories in Orange County. It's called Taller San Jose. That means St. Joseph's Workshop. It is located in Santa Ana in an area that at one time was known for much gang violence and crime, but Taller San Jose has done much to mitigate that reputation. Here with us in the studio today is Shauna Smith. She is the executive director of Taller San Jose. Shauna, welcome, and thanks for coming down to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us about Sister Eileen McNerney. She looms very large in the history of Taller San Jose, and tell us about her and the beginnings of the ministry.
Sure. Sister Eileen McNerney is a sister of St. Joseph of Orange and was really motivated in the early and mid-90s from an experience of living in a neighborhood with five other sisters in Santa Ana, where she saw firsthand young people who were being killed in gang violence. And she tells a story about one night. It was a hot summer night in Santa Ana, and no air conditioning, so the windows were open. And her home backed up to an apartment complex where there was a mother wailing all night for the loss of a second child to gang violence. And that moved her into action. And so her mission, which is now Taller San Jose's mission, was to reach out to those young people who were disconnected from opportunities to build a life of self-sufficiency and meaning.
Now, as I recall, Taller San Jose is in that very neighborhood you mentioned, the Logan neighborhood in Santa Ana, correct?
It is. We're just a few blocks from where Sister Eileen lived in that home in the Logan neighborhood of Santa Ana near St. Joseph's Church. And we actually have two centers in that neighborhood, one that houses our construction program and one that houses our other two academies.
We're going to be getting to that in just a second, but for the time being, who are the young people who are helped by Taller San Jose? What's their situation in life? How would you describe it?
So as I mentioned, we believe that every young person deserves the opportunity to live a self-sufficient and meaningful life. And unfortunately, even in a wonderful place like Orange County, there are pockets of extreme poverty in our communities, and these are the young people and the neighborhoods where Taller San Jose students live. Typically, they're 18 to 28 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
Our average age is about 22, so they tend to be a little younger, and their educational journeys have been interrupted. A lot of them have not finished high school because maybe they had a baby at a young age or got involved in the criminal justice system, and so they need help with literacy skills. They've not held jobs before, many of them, so they don't have job skills to offer an employer, and we're really trying to help them develop those skills so they can connect to the workforce and build a future for themselves.
Well, and the common denominator for most of them, I imagine, that Sister Eileen observed was poverty. She identified that as the most significant root problem affecting high-risk young people in Orange County. And she saw that training these young people, as you mentioned, to hold good jobs is the most direct way out of that poverty. Now, that seems very simple. Is it that simple, or is there a little more to it that you've learned over the years?
Well, it's true. The power of employment is significant in the life of a young person. And someone who's disconnected from employment opportunities, these are the young people that we see involved in crime and other violence in the neighborhoods throughout Orange County where these are issues. And poverty is the theme. We are talking about young people who have not had mentors in their family, who maybe have experienced a lot of instability because of immigration, a lack of commitment to their ongoing education, and they really need assistance in building those skills that make them marketable in the job place. That means overcoming a lot of different barriers, like simple things like how do you get to work every day?
Yeah.
If you're riding public transportation, your employment opportunities are much more limited than if you have a car. And if you have a couple of children, childcare might be an issue. So then you need resources to help you with childcare. If you're not strong in math skills, you're not going to be successful on a construction job site. So these are, you know, there are many small things that add up to big barriers for young people living in poverty. And those things are the things that stand in their way when they're out looking for employment.
And Tire San Jose is filling in these gaps. Let's say you've got somebody whose math skills are somewhat deficient, but they are very good with their hands, and they would otherwise be a good match. So you bring them up to speed a bit, yes?
That's right. And I think this is the, you know, the charism of the Sisters of St. Joseph following through what we do, which is caring for the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, identifying where the needs are in the neighborhood and the people that you're serving and bringing all the different types of support that are needed to help serve that need. And it's different for each young person, but it's through a lot of partnerships and, you know, many years, 20 years of figuring out how to serve this population that we've built a very successful program.
Well, it started out a bit modestly, but very successfully, as I recall. We were talking about this just a minute ago when we were off the air, that in the beginning, 20 years ago, Tire San Jose was known as a place where you had these wonderful young carpenters who were learning their skills down there, and they were making these fantastic patio benches.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone far beyond that.
It has. We certainly learned from those early days that putting young people to work and putting them in a work environment was the best way to teach job skills. So a young person who comes to Tire San Jose is not sitting in a classroom being lectured to about how to be a good employee. We treat them like they are our employee, and we train them on the job. And we learn from doing that way, and so do our young people. So we've gone well beyond the benches now, and we operate 4 different workforce academies that serve important industries here in our county.
Well, I don't know if you have these exact stats right at your fingertips here, but I'd really love to know. In the 2 decades that Tire San Jose has been around, about how many young people have been trained, and about how many of those young people have gotten jobs? The percentage is pretty high, I imagine.
It is. So over the last 20 years, we've served over 5,000 young people here in Orange County, and 77% of them have found employment.
Fantastic.
We're very proud of that.
Well, and even more importantly, I'm thinking, and we, again, we're talking about this earlier as well, how many of these people really stay with it, that go on to live vastly improved lives over their previous situation?
Many of them. You know, overall population, about 75% complete the 2-year program from beginning to end. So when you think about that, this is a population of young people that's very unstable.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't finished school. If they've been employed, it's been in a, you know, revolving door type of situation. To start and finish a 2-year program that requires a high level of commitment, and to have 75% of them do that, I think speaks to the depth and the meaningfulness of the programming.
Well, if you look just at the name Taller San Jose, a lot of people might think, "Oh, okay, St. Joseph Carpentry." That you're training a bunch of contractors, and you are, of course. But you also train people for medical careers, office careers, green technology jobs. That really is a long way from your roots.
It is. It's a long way, but it's certainly based in the original goal of Sister Eileen, which is to connect young people to jobs and to make sure they have the skills to be successful long term.
Now, if people were to come down on any particular day to Taller San Jose, would they see the place just as a hive of activity? I imagine they would.
They would. You would see young people in hard hats and tool belts building buildings in our facility. You'd see young men and women in medical scrubs taking vitals and suturing. You'd see our office careers students in a college class on our campus. So there's a lot of innovative things going on there, and it is always buzzing with activity.
Well, a lot of our listeners I know may be intrigued by all this, and they'd like to know how they can get involved, either as donors or as volunteers, or if they are business people, they might like to know about hiring your graduates. What can you tell them about all that?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, the training we provide and the services we provide are really critical to helping our young people, but if it doesn't connect to a job, then we're not getting them where we need to get them. So employers who are looking for, you know, skilled entry-level workers in any of those areas that you mentioned can partner with Taller by providing employment opportunities. And they will have the Taller San Jose stamp of approval and our support. Certainly, we are always looking for people who want to give philanthropic support, and we couldn't do our work without a cadre of volunteers, whether it's for special events, mock interviewers, professional coaches. There's lots of ways volunteers can get involved as well.
Is there a number to call?
Yes. So you can reach Taller San Jose at 714-543-5105, and that'll get you to our main office. That number again is 714-543-5105.
Fantastic. A website?
Yes, www.TallerSanJose.org. That's www.TallerSanJose.org.
Okay. Well, everyone, if you are of mind to get involved, please do call that number, go to that website, and they will be very, very happy to accommodate you. Shauna Smith, it has been a pleasure to hear that Taller San Jose is as firmly on the rails and fulfilling the dreams of its founder, Sister Eileen McInerney, as it is. We will check in with you often during your next 20 years. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000. I'm Patrick Mott.